John Daly aboard the British man of war Bellerophon outside Plymouth Harbor. The rumor on this 31st day of July 1815 that Napoleon is a captain of the English Navy is true. He's here, not more than 60 feet away from him below deck. Not a single one of the crowd of international reporters summoned here by the British government has seen him yet. But in a few moments, the captain of the ship will hold a news conference. And we hope that he will explain the mystery that has held the world in suspense since the Battle of Waterloo. Namely, where has Napoleon been for the past month? How was he captured? What are the British going to do with him now that they've finally caught the greatest conqueror of all time? I wish you could see this picture, this man of war, its deck gleaming with bristling cannon, crowded with...
Plymouth Harbor, England, July 31st, 1815. You are there.
The news bursts upon a startled world. The mighty Napoleon, captive on a British warship, after Waterloo. All things are as they were then, except for one thing.
You are there.
And now...
The deck of the Bellerophon, July 31st, 1815, and John Daly.
Excitement and speculation. But the problem of what to do with Napoleon is certainly a difficult one for the British government. The British, as we all know, have always considered Napoleon their most implacable foe. He's a firebrand, too hot to handle, too inflammatory to let go. May be true that Napoleon is the most hated man in Europe, but to the common people, he's a hero. This is the man who has brought panic to every royal heart on the continent. This is the Corsican who rose from humble birth to become emperor of many kingdoms. But now the eagle is caged, his wings are clipped, and his claws are about to be drawn. For this time, the British mean that he shall never escape them again, as he did from Elba. But what to do with him? That is the problem, and we may know the answer. Oh, there are the muskets again. The soldiers in the guard boat are firing to keep the sightseeing boats from coming too close to the Bellerophon. And that's the guard shouting to warn the sightseeing boats away. There are about 1,000 boats of all description near our ship, each one of them jammed with people trying to get a glimpse of the fallen emperor. And the wharves, 200 yards off, are just a mass of humanity. Oh, here comes another one of our bulletins. The sailors here on board ship are very obliging. They keep us constantly informed of Napoleon's doings below decks with blackboard communiques. I can just make out this message. It's chalked up on the board. It says that Napoleon reading Life of George Washington. Napoleon is reading the life of George Washington in his cabin. Well, it seems a bit late for that. Oh, here comes Captain Maitland, the commander of the ship. The reporters are crowding around him. He's a young man, not yet 30, I'd say. He's the lion of all England today, the man who has delivered to his country her greatest enemy. Let's hear what's going on.
Gentlemen, I'd like to answer all your questions, but please, one at a time. On behalf of the Admiralty, I have this announcement to make.
Louder, please.
On behalf of the Admiralty, I have the following announcement to make. The Cabinet has arrived at a decision concerning the future of Napoleon Bonaparte. Lord Keith, Admiral of the Channel Fleet, is on his way now to deliver personally the orders of His Royal Highness the Prince Regent concerning the final disposition of this matter. That is the end of the announcement. I know no more about it than you do, sirs.
Louder, please.
I know no more about it than you do. I know nothing of what is contained in the announcement. Lord Keith should be here in a matter of minutes. But meanwhile, if there are any other questions, I should be happy to answer them.
Well, Captain Maitland, can you tell us how Napoleon was captured?
Napoleon was not captured. He gave himself up voluntarily.
Impossible. Napoleon would never give himself up.
Never. If the gentleman from Prussia does not believe my statements, he need not accept them.
Well, where did this voluntary surrender take place, Captain?
At Rosemont Harbor on the west coast of France. I gave His Majesty every assurance.
By His Majesty, I presume you mean Napoleon.
That is correct. It has been our habit, while he's been aboard our ship, to call him His Majesty. This is never too great an effort on the part of any Englishman.
Napoleon is an upstart and never deserved any royal title.
That may be a Russian view. It is not mine.
Captain,
Did you promise Napoleon an asylum in England? I think you will recall that this hypothesis is nowhere to be found in any of my statements.
Well, sir, do you and your men observe all courtesies usually accorded an emperor?
Wherever possible, we maintain the proper attitude.
Captain, our American listeners would like to know what that means.
For American listeners, it means that Englishmen always try to do the right thing at the right time.
I'm sure of that, sir. Do you dine with Napoleon, Captain?
I do.
I see. Well, who sits at the head of the table?
His Majesty.
Thank you. Captain Maitland, would you mind telling us your personal impression of Napoleon?
I should be delighted, sir. Emperor Napoleon is an extraordinary man whom it was my fortune to secure and bring to England. It may appear surprising that I, a British officer, am prejudiced in favor of one who has caused so many calamities to his country. But to such an extent that he has the power of pleasing that there are few people who could sit at the same table with him without feeling a sensation of pity. And I perhaps do regret that a man who possessed so many fascinating qualities should be reduced to his present situation.
Will we be able to interview Napoleon?
His Majesty is aware that the newsmen and radio correspondents are aboard. I'm not certain, but it is my belief that he means to make some kind of public statement.
Sir, will he be allowed to speak freely?
It is the policy of our government at all times present all sides of all questions. Thank you, gentlemen, for your patience. And for speaking one at a time.
Captain Maitland has turned away. He's going below again, perhaps to speak to His Majesty. Well, you heard the captain's announcement. The British government has reached a decision concerning the fate of Napoleon, and Lord Keith, the Admiral of the Channel Fleet, will arrive at any minute with the actual orders in his pocket. The focus of attention the world over is aboard this ship on Napoleon Bonaparte. And what manner of man is he? Well, we have a correspondent in Paris right now with a man who probably knows Napoleon best, having served under him for many years. That man is Charles Maurice de Talleyrand, who is not unknown to Americans. He lived in New York and also in Philadelphia during the last days of the French Revolution. And this incredible statesman has been foreign minister to Napoleon and, believe it or not, has also served under the Bourbon King, Louis XVIII. So we take you now to Paris and Jackson Beck.
I am here at the home of Monsieur de Talleyrand. He is sitting opposite me. Monsieur de Talleyrand, what do you think the British will do with Napoleon?
They think rather peculiarly in this tight little island, but they do not think foolishly. Whatever they will do with him, it will certainly not be to Monsieur Bonaparte's liking.
Monsieur? Did you always refer to the Emperor as Monsieur?
No. At times it was inexpedient, but whenever possible I like to refer to him by his true designation, and that is Monsieur.
I see. That is because you and the Emperor are very close friends?
Close friends? I knew the ex-Emperor very well, and because of that I believe I can assess him better than most people knew him. But my personal opinion of him is of no great importance. I like to judge a man by what he has done. There is no question about his military genius and a rare skill with people, but there are certain characteristics of Monsieur Napoleon with which I'm rather painfully familiar.
Painfully? Then you and the Emperor were not good friends.
There are many things which Monsieur Bonaparte did which I found very distasteful. For one thing, he had the most diabolical spy system in history, consisting of specially trained, beautiful young men and women whom he kept in great luxury. Through them, he knew everything that was going on in France and elsewhere in his empire. If you were in any way hostile to him, he would soon know about it, and then you were a marked man.
Unless you were very careful and reserved your thoughts for a more expedient time. Is that it, Monsieur de Talleyrand?
Expedience is an art given to few men. Thought was inexpedient and had his throat cut by Monsieur Napoleon. Hoche was poisoned. Flaubert was stabbed with a poignard. And Pichegru, poor fellow, was strangled in his prison cell. Not to mention a few other misdemeanors of Monsieur Napoleon, such as the massacres at Lodi, Pavia, Venezia, the Italian frontier, the slaughter of the Arabs in Palestine, the murder of the French people on the steps of Saint-Roch. Oh, yes. Behind the glitter of Napoleon is a bloodthirsty soul. He would sacrifice untold lives to further his vanity and ambition.
Then you have no concern over the fate of your ex-emperor.
I'm sorry, but I do not feel sorry for Monsieur Bonaparte.
Thank you, Monsieur de Talleyrand. This is Jackson Beck returning you now to John Daly aboard the Bellerophon in Plymouth Harbor, England.
Lord Keith has not arrived with the orders from London as yet, since Napoleon is apparently still in his cabin. However, according to the last blackboard communique, he has switched from reading The Life of George Washington to playing Bataillon, or just plain ordinary blackjack, as we call it at home. But we do have at our microphone now the Countess Bertrand, wife of the Grand Marshal Bertrand, one of the members of Napoleon's retinue. The Countess is a tall, slender young woman, has a very sensitive and expressive face, which seems capable of many moods of emotion.
It's all right, Mike. You killed
me. Oh, that's fine, Countess. Now, Countess Bertrand, how many followers of Napoleon are there aboard this ship?
I believe 60. Marshal Montholon, General Savary, General Alimont, Count Dascas and others, including wives, children, and servants. All of them are intensely devoted to the Emperor, determined to share his fate.
And are you of the same mind?
Well, I respect and revere Emperor Napoleon, but I see no sense in joining him should he be isolated in some horrible case. I must think of my children.
Of course, sir, but what is your opinion of Napoleon? Can you tell us something about him?
He is the greatest man alive, whose life you will not see again in your lifetime. He's a man of fire and determination who always has his way with everyone.
Emperors usually do.
Yes, but Napoleon only had his way in order to better accomplish his great project. He's not bloodthirsty, as people say. I know him to be kind and thoughtful and generous. But when some great end is at stake, I can assure you he can be as firm and unyielding as a stone wall.
Countess Bertrand, how do you happen to be able to speak English so well with hardly a trace of an accent?
I have no accent. I was born an Englishwoman. My maiden name was Dillon.
Thank you, Countess Bertrand. And now here is Monsieur Marchand, premier valet to Napoleon.
Monsieur?
Monsieur Marchand, oh, excuse me a minute. The soldiers in one of the guard boats are firing again at a small sightseeing craft and trying to get up close to the Bellerophon. The boat is jammed with sightseers. They're shouting and calling out that they want to have a look at bony parts, as they call them. The sightseers are disregarding those shots entirely this time and coming straight on. And there goes the guard boat after them to change their minds. They've rammed that little boat. It looks like it's going to turn over. No, the boat has righted itself, but still four or five people were knocked overboard, and they're floundering around in the water, trying to swim back towards the boat. They're pulling them back in one by one, and I think, yes, they've all been pulled back into it, and the guard has won them away. This time they're rowing back to shore just about as fast as they can. Well, this is just one reporter's opinion, but it seems to me that that was rather unnecessary and cruel. It might very easily have ended tragically. What do you think, Monsieur Marchand?
It was not a nice thing to do.
Well, now, Monsieur Marchand, as valet to the Emperor, I know that...
Premier valet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, as premier valet to the Emperor, what is he like to work for?
He is a man. Sometimes he's good, sometimes he's bad. When he is bad, I scold him.
Oh,
you are smiling?
Yes.
How can a valet scold an Emperor? Maybe. Not only do I scold him, but when his orders are not right, I pay no attention to them.
Well, that doesn't sound like the stories we've heard about him.
Stories? What? There is a story that Napoleon sleeps 1 hour a night. Do you believe it?
Well...
I know for a fact that he sleeps 4 hours a night.
Well, that's not much.
There is a story that Napoleon eats only once a day. At the Tuileries, we always had fowls roasting in different states. The Emperor not only ate 3 meals a day, but had, snacks all night long.
Well, what about this? I've heard it said that Napoleon never spent more than 20 minutes at a meal.
Ah, now you have heard correctly. He is a man of restless energy. Every day he rides 25 miles on horseback, sometimes 50.
With all this activity, he must be a very nervous and excitable.
Nervous, excitable? I have seen him many times receiving grave news. Such news that would make an ordinary man shake and pluck out his hair. But not the Emperor. No, no. At this moment, his mind is like a razor. He thinks like a machine, so clear, so sharp. Panic? You could not even begin to explain the word to him.
Say, you're just a little partial to your emperor, aren't you, Monsieur Marchand?
Very. Otherwise, I would not have stayed with him so long.
Yeah, of course, sir.
What can it help but admire him? He can do the work of five men. He uses his mind like a chest to draw.
How's that?
First, he pulls out one drawer, one problem, and he concentrates on it. Then he closes the drawer, and he pulls out another. He concentrates. Then he goes to sleep. He closes all the drawers and sleeps like a baby.
Oh, come now, Monsieur Marchand. Your emperor must have one weakness.
Oui, and he will tell you what he is.
What is it?
He has a small foot. He's rather, how you say, vain. Yes, vain about it.
Really?
Really. He loves to show it off to advantage in fine shoes.
Oh.
Think of that. An emperor.
Even as you and I.
Oui. And I will tell you another weakness. Napoleon is exceedingly fond of eau de cologne.
So?
Oh, am I? As a matter of fact, between us, we both use at least 60 bottles or more.
Well, that's an awful lot of eau de cologne. And thank you very much, Monsieur Marchand. Thanks a lot. Napoleon has not come on deck as yet. Lord Keith has not arrived with the order, so let's see what's happening ashore. Over to the jam-packed docks of Plymouth, 200 yards away, and Ken Robin. Acknowledging the crowd. This whole thing is unbelievable. By one word in the middle of this
crowd, I wouldn't believe it. The crowd is in a carnival spirit. Several more people have fallen into the harbor. It will be a miracle if nobody is drowned this day. And now, Napoleon is leading the poop deck, so over to John Daly.
Napoleon is on his way here from the poop deck, and he has agreed to an interview on condition that only one reporter do the interviewing. Here he is now, flanked by Captain Maitland and several high-ranking officers of the Emperor's retinue. Napoleon walks in a slow but firm step. He's wearing a green uniform, a plain gold-hilted sword, and a small cocked hat. His only decoration is the Star of the Legion of Honor. The sailors on deck have removed their hats at his appearance, so have all the reporters and correspondents, including myself. Napoleon was reputed to be a short man, but this is apparently untrue, for I'd say he's about 5'7". He's stumped now just a few feet away from the mic. I can see him very plainly. His eyes are light gray. They're in constant motion, and in the short space of time since he's been close enough to see me, he's looked me over carefully 3 or 4 times. Captain Maitland and the Emperor are now approaching the microphone.
Monsieur, veuillez vous présenter Jean Daly de
Sévres.
Je suis heureux de faire votre connaissance.
C'est un honneur pour moi, sire. Sire, would you be good enough to speak in English?
I understand English, but do not speak it very well. Could you oblige me by speaking in French?
I would be very happy to do so, sire, but for the benefit of our American listeners...
No, we will speak in English, and I will try to make myself understood.
Thank you, sire. Sire, who do you think is the greatest military leader today?
I am.
What about Wellington, who defeated you at Waterloo?
I do not minimize the excellence of the Duke of Wellington, but his choice of battlefield and his permitting me to surprise him was an error. Had my Marshal de Grouchy arrived on time, the Duke would have suffered a great disaster. However, all generals make mistakes. The Duke of Wellington made less mistakes than most others.
The Duke of Wellington has paid you a great compliment, sire. He said that he considers your presence on the battlefield equivalent to an additional 40,000 men in the balance.
Nevertheless, had he captured me, he would have had me shot.
However, he is opposed to war. He said recently that nothing except a battle lost can be half so melancholy as a battle won.
That is a well-turned phrase. It seems that Waterloo was a melancholy business for the both of us.
Sire, in an interview with one of our correspondents in Paris just a few moments ago, Monsieur de Talleyrand stated, "Behind the glitter of Napoleon is a bloodthirsty soul." Would you care to comment on that?
That is a clever question. You expect me to become angry. Very well, I will. The triumph of Talleyrand is the triumph of immorality. He has sold everything to France and has sold France to everyone. Betrayed everybody and every time. Talleyrand treats his enemies as if someday they will be his friends, and his friends as if someday they will be his enemies.
Sire, whom do you consider responsible for your downfall?
Myself. No one but myself did me any harm. The expedition to Moscow was the cause of my downfall.
Then is it true that you have said that you should have died at Moscow?
That is quite so. I ought to have died at Moscow. In which case, I would have become the greatest conqueror the world has ever known. Misfortune is that when a man seeks most for death, he cannot find it. Men were killed all around me, before, behind, everywhere, but for me, no bullet.
Well, sire, whom do you think helped you most in your rise to power?
Myself. What is most extraordinary and unparalleled in history is that I rose from a private citizen to the astonishing height of power, without having committed a single crime to obtain it.
Sire, I beg to differ with you.
You have a list of crimes, perhaps?
The people of the world, sire, consider you a tyrant.
A tyrant to whom? To the diseased, degenerate bourbons, perhaps? J'ai été un tyran pour les égoïstes qui gouvernaient l'Europe. Mais je n'ai pas été un tyran pour les
Français. Is speaking volubly in French, saying he was a tyrant only to royalty, never to the people of France. The people of the army considered him a tyrant, he says. They would never have rallied to him after Elba. And he goes on in France greatly.
I was no tyrant to the majority of people of my country.
Well, sire, would you care to explain certain incidents which have been considered acts of tyranny?
I am most anxious to hear these incidents.
For one thing, I refer to the slaughter of 3,000 Arabs who had already surrendered in the Palestine campaign. They were unarmed, sire, and your prisoners at Jaffa.
It is true I had them killed. There was no food. It was either their lives or my soldiers. I have always considered it preferable when necessary to kill enemy troops rather than my own.
I also refer to the death of General Pichegru, sire, an enemy of yours whom you had strangled in prison while awaiting trial.
Oh, I recommend that you do not waste any tears over the death of General Pichegru. Pichegru, a traitor! C'est un vieux bourbon!
Napoleon is once again speaking French. With great heat, he says that Pichegru was a traitor and deliberately sent 20,000 French troops to their death, and still speaking in French, he goes on tearing down the reputation.
I have precious few people executed, Monsieur Daly, and never for any personal reason or for revenge, but always because they were enemies of the people. Whatever you may...
Lord Keith has arrived. He's being piped over the side. Napoleon has turned his back to us. He's staring out over the ocean. He seems to be terribly alone. Captain Maitland has hurried to Lord Keith's side and is now chatting with the Admiral of the Channel Fleet. This is the moment we've all been waiting for. The fate of Napoleon lies in the orders that Lord Keith is carrying on his person. The members of Napoleon's retinue are gathering around their chief. He has still not spoken a word to anyone since he left us. He still gazes abstractly towards France. Countess Bertrand is there. Monsieur Marchand, we also recognize General Savary and Lannimore. Countess Bertrand looks very pale. She leans against the railing. Now, Lord Keith and his group are approaching Napoleon and his retinue. Napoleon has turned. He looks directly at Lord Keith. He stands firmly, legs slightly apart, waiting in his now famous pose.
Comment se porte, aujourd'hui,
très bien.
Sire, I have made the orders of the Prince Regent's government concerning your disposition. May I have your permission to read it?
Very easy.
Lord Keith, uncapping a tube, withdraws the orders. His face is a blank. He clears his throat, casts a quick look at Napoleon, who stares at him imperviously.
From His Royal Highness, the Prince Regent of England, General Bonaparte. It would have been inconsistent with our duty towards our country, the allies of England, if General Bonaparte possessed the means of again disturbing the repose of Europe. It is on this account becomes absolutely imperative to restrain his personal liberty. The island of St. Helena has been chosen as his future residence.
Rear Admiral
Sir George Cockburn will convey General Bonaparte and his suite to this island. General Savary and General Lallemand are forbidden to join.
Napoleon demands an immediate interview with the Prince Regent of England.
I am sorry, but this is utterly impossible. We cannot make such an appointment for you.
Shame! You're a violent and human being!
Napoleon has turned to calm her. The other members of Napoleon's retinue are hurling abuses and curses at the English.
Lord Keith, over here.
May I ask you, sir, why Napoleon was not granted an interview with the French Regent of England?
Because Napoleon is a magician with people. In half an hour, he and the Prince Regent would have been the best of friends. And there would have been no St. Helena.
Well, sir, have you approached his Royal Highness in this? Or amidst all this confusion, Napoleon is once again speaking angrily in French, this time attacking Lord Keith, saying he did not believe the rumors about exile to St. Helena. The whole idea, he says, fills him with horror. Then might better have signed my death warrant. Instead, he says it's impossible for me to live long in such environment. Napoleon is still talking pale and impassioned. This is the last great moment on the stage of history. His fate has been decided. The rumors were true. It is St. Helena, and this marks the end of the Napoleonic era. He shall not be given a chance.
Plymouth Harbor, England, July 31st, 1815. Napoleon is exiled to St. Helena, and Europe begins a new age.
Listening to The Exile of Napoleon, another broadcast in the series You Are There. This program was presented originally by CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System, and came to you through the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.